Today on Straight Talk Africa, we honor the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We examine his legacy and his quest for dignity, civil rights, and social justice. How would he respond to the recent challenges in Ferguson, Missouri, New York, and around the world? That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. It's Wednesday, January 21st. I am Shaka Salih.
Hello, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Mariama Diallo, your social media reporter.
Today, we'll discuss Dr. King's commitment to nonviolent action and peaceful protests for social justice in America.
Well, there's a lot to talk about today. Coming up later, we'll see what our audience has to say on the culture of nonviolent protest. I can't wait to share their comments. Hope you'll stay with us.
But first, the third Monday in January is a federal holiday in the United States, marking the birthday of renowned civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. This year, the holiday had special meaning for many following recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, and New York. My colleague Joy Wagner has our report.
If he were alive today, what would Martin Luther King say about the deaths of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City, both unarmed and killed in confrontations with police, and about the anger and demonstrations that have followed?
Because I have a dream. My poor little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character.
King's famous I Have a Dream speech, delivered during the 1963 March on Washington, was an iconic event in the struggle to end racial segregation and establish equal rights for all citizens of the United States. Last month, there was another march on Washington. Tens of thousands of demonstrators in the nation's capital called for justice in the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner. This demonstration was peaceful. And Martin Luther King's niece, Alveda King, whose father, A.D. King, was also a civil rights activist, suggested the violent protests in Ferguson, when a grand jury did not indict the police officer involved in Brown's death, was not the right approach. She called the Ferguson protest slogan, "No justice, no peace," aggressive, and said only peaceful protests can lead to any positive results, recalling the day in 1963 that her own home was bombed.
I remember my dad is standing on a car, and the people wanted to do just what they did in Ferguson. The people were trying to turn over a police car, they wanted to throw rocks, and they were just trying to be very violent. And I remember Dad standing on a car, there's a photograph of A.D. standing on a car with a megaphone with a young man. And he says, "Don't riot. Don't be violent. My family and I are okay. Please, go home and pray."
Some critics of the protests suggest the demonstrations have created animosity towards police and may have led to the killing of two New York City police officers, Rafael Ramos and Wen Xing Liu. But one of the positive things to emerge is a peaceful discussion about racial discrimination that's taking place in social media.
So when I see the hashtag Black Lives Matter, I believe black lives from conception in the woman till natural death, the sick, the elderly, the young, the old, the educated, those who need things in communities, all black lives and all human lives matter.
In honor of this holiday, parades are organized in many cities and hymns are sung in churches across the country. Americans, including the president and his family, take part in community projects aimed to bring Americans together. Alveda King says that this was her uncle's dream, to see this nation peaceful and united.
Joy, thanks for that interesting report. Now joining us here in our Washington studios are two distinguished guests.
Reverend Marcia Dyson, founder and CEO of Women's Global Initiative, an organization that works to enhance the lives of women by increasing their wealth, education, and civil participation. She also serves on the board with Mama Sarah Obama Foundation. Oh, Marcia, I have to say, frankly, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. And last but not least, Reverend Aniedi Okule, Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a non-profit organization that educates and advocates for transformation of U.S. policies toward Africa. Well, I have to say frankly that it's always a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you.
And in fact, a Happy New Year, of course, to both of you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
You're most welcome. Later in the program, we'll give you, the audience, a chance to call and talk with our guests. The number to call is 202-619-3111. U.S. country code is 1. Before we begin today's discussion, I am now joined on the phone from Kajatu Jaro, mother of Amadou Jaro, an unarmed West African immigrant from Guinea who was killed by four New York police officers on February 4th, 1999. Ms. Jaro currently serves as the founder of the Amadou Jaro Foundation that promotes racial healing through educational programs and is a frequent lecturer. She is the co-author of My Heart Will Cross This Ocean, My Story, My Son Amadou. Ms. Jaro joins us on the phone from Gettysburg, Maryland, a suburb of the nation's capital. Good afternoon, Ms. Jaro.
Good afternoon.
I have to say, frankly, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have an opportunity to host you two for the first time on Straight Talk Africa.
It's an honor to be on your show. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome, ma'am. Talk to us about the significance of your foundation, very briefly.
The Amadou Jaro Foundation was founded right after my son was killed. We decided to establish an organization to give light to what happened to Amadou and also for his legacy, so that we can work hard and bring people together of all races, all nationalities together, and promote racial healing, because we believe that with racial healing, we can begin to move forward and have a better future than Amadou fit, because his death has galvanized the public. Everyone understand what happened on February 4th, 1999, but to have a positive outcome was the reason to establish the foundation and help African students obtain scholarship, because Amadou's goal was to have an American degree in the U.S. before he died.
So if you were to give us very briefly a report card on that, what is the reaction so far? How has it, in fact, been received?
The program of the foundation has been well received. We have awarded about 53 African of African descent student scholarship. Some of them have went to have a higher education, graduated and doing political sciences in a renowned university in the country. And also for the community, we are hosting some programs to address the issue of police and community relations. In fact, this coming February 4th will mark the 16 years of my son's death, and we are hosting a conference on police and community relations at Columbia University on February 5th.
What is the criteria? How does it, for example, how does one qualify to benefit from the foundation? Do you specifically target, for example, students from Guinea, Africa, or globally?
It's globally because it has to be African students who will apply, go through the process, and also students who are of African descent. So that really is a broad base. We are partners with the Bronx Community College, and this is where we house the foundation. And the application process is vetted through the BCC scholarship program.
You know, I saw you on television not long time ago here in the Mall, and with the Reverend, of course, Rushapton, and many, many, many other people. Given that at one time, of course, when you look back, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King said that among his dreams was that one day he hoped that his children would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. What is your assessment on that so far?
I think we have come a long way. Dr. King has changed the world and have helped people to see beyond race. However, when incidents like my son's death and the cases of Ferguson and New York City and many different families have lost loved ones unjustifiably through law enforcement who's supposed to serve and protect, we can say that sadly the dream has not been realized fully. But however, if you look at violence in urban areas also, and lack of education, lack of opportunities, we are saying that we need to do everything we can to work hard and build on his legacy. I was honored to meet with his late widow, Mrs. Coretta Skin, Mrs. Scott King, and she put me under her wing and invited me and pray with me and talk to me about the importance of civil rights. Because us coming from Africa and my generation, young generation, we need to be educated. My experience is from a personal loss. But the response from all these elected officials, community leaders, civil rights leaders, has helped me to build on that foundation. But we cannot stop because this is ongoing. If we don't work together and come together and involve all different races, we may never see the full dream realized.
Now, your son, of course, was killed back in 1999. And yet, there are a lot of other children who still become victims of what people would call police brutality. What do you think that needs to be done in order for at least police officers in this country to take some lessons, to learn some lessons from, of course, what happened to your son back in 1999, a man who was an armed and a man, frankly, who faced four white policemen, 41 bullets, 19 hit the target.
Yes. Rightly, Amadou's story has waked, shocked the consciousness of everyone in this world, especially in America. In fact, during the march last month, I brought the Time magazine where my son's face was there, staring, and had a T-shirt on. It says USA. And then we said we have to address the issue of police brutality and race in America. But I have met so many families who have lost loved ones. Because I'm connected, whenever I see these kind of cases happening, I always relive my nightmare, my tragedy. So we came together. I met personally many different families, and we talk on the phone, we meet, we pray together. This is so hard to absorb that kind of situation and also move forward and pretend that nothing happened. I think the whole system of the criminal justice system is need to be reviewed, especially we are calling for to have independent prosecutors, because whenever there's a shooting case, the DA itself cannot have the liberty, and also it's difficult for them to indict a police officers because they live and work together. It's like a family. You cannot indict your own child. So if we have independent prosecutors, whenever there's a police shooting case, to review and really make an independent judgment whether or not these officers need to be indicted, that would be a right way to do. Also, the body camera on police officers has been called by the Michael Brown family, and we support that idea. Because if you talk about cases like that, Eric Garner was killed. We have the video. It didn't help to get the indictment. However, it helped to brought the light into this case so that the whole world see the injustice that was done when Eric Garner was killed, because that video existed. If not, we can just move forward and pretend that nothing, you know, is. It will be like a divided community. But this Eric Garner case has really helped to bring the light and let the community, you know, of different races to condemn this situation. Because indictment doesn't mean punishment. Indictment is to give a chance to have the justice run its course so we know really what happened. And it did, the family didn't get it. The community didn't get it. My son, on the other hand, didn't have a video. We had the indictment, but before we can go to trial in the Bronx, it was moved. The case was moved in a rural area in Albany. And it was almost like a guarantee to have the acquittal of those officers who killed my son.
Very interesting. I happen to be very familiar with Albany because, in fact, I did my undergraduate at the State University of New York, Albany campus. So I understand exactly what you're talking about and where you are coming from. On that note, thanks, Ms. Kajatu Jaro, for joining us today via telephone link up from Gettysburg, Maryland. We hope that next time we can have you join us live from our studios here in Washington, D.C. Now, we'll pause for a short break and would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on the social networking website Twitter. And we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka. And join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOAMLK. And we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
Let's take a look at some important dates. The Montgomery bus boycott. The protest began on December 1st, 1955, after Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to give up her seat on a bus to a white person. The next day, Martin Luther King proposed a citywide boycott of public transportation. On December 20th, 1956, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the Alabama District Court's ruling that segregated buses were unconstitutional. The Albany Movement. In December 1961, Dr. King was jailed during a mass arrest of peaceful demonstrations to protest city segregation policies. He declined bail until the city changed its segregation policies. Although Dr. King's move failed, it was credited as a key lesson in strategy and tactics for the civil rights movement. The March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. On August 28, 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in support of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. The political rally attracted nearly 300,000 participants, and observers estimated that nearly 80% of the marchers were black.
Sia Nyama Karoma, the First Lady of Sierra Leone, speaks to VOA on the Ebola crisis.
I would want the people in West Africa to know that Ebola is real. Ebola kills. Early detection and prompt treatment can save lives. And I'm asking our people not to victimize or stigmatize survivors. Ebola is a challenge, but together we'll all be able to overcome it.
That was Sia Nyama Karoma, the First Lady of Sierra Leone, speaking to VOA Africa on the Ebola crisis.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui, and welcome back. Today we are discussing Martin Luther King's commitment to nonviolent action and peaceful protest for social justice in America. Joining us today, of course, in our studios here are two distinguished guests. Reverend Masiya Dyson, founder and CEO of Women's Global Initiative, an organization that works to enhance the lives of women by increasing their wealth, education, and civil participation. She also serves on the board of the Mama Sarah Obama Foundation. And the Reverend Aniedi Okule, Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, a nonprofit organization that educates and advocates for transformation of U.S. policies toward Africa. Well, once again, I have to say, Masiya and Aniedi, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa. And, of course, a happy new year to you both.
Happy new
Thank
year
you. Year happy new year. Glad to be here.
You're most welcome. Of course, you just interacted with an incredibly, I have to say, frankly, articulate lady, lady that has gone through a lot, and yet she still remains on her two feet with a lot of dignity. When you think about her son, Amadou Diarro, 41 bullets in a 22, 23-year-old kid, really, that is unarmed, all he has is a wallet. What does that tell you?
That, like then, and what we've seen post-Ferguson, that something that Dr. King realized, that racism still exists, and it is in the strand and in the DNA in America. Mm-hmm. It's not an indictment on America or Americans, but it is an indictment upon those systemic institutions, which to me seems as if they have, in the year 2015, a fear of the black planet, and especially our young black men. I applaud Mrs. Diallo for her wonderful calm, her sense of inclusivity, which is also something that Dr. King believed in, and it's something that I believe in too, you know. But it's really hard when you have an African-American son and you have African-American grandsons, and every day I get up and I pray for them because I never know when they will be profiled or if their lives in danger. So I believe that we have still a long way to go.
And Eddie, one might, of course, say that the police may probably have had a probable cause of shooting at this young man. But do you, in fact, need 41 bullets, 19 hitting the target, and you are four police officers? Why don't you shoot to disable the person so that you can find out what he was trying to do?
You know, you touch on something really, really embedded in this issue, namely there is embedded in our cultural and social psyche a deep-seated fear of the black guy. Let me explain. Something happened. The testimony of the officer that shot the Mike in Ferguson is very telling. What did he say? He said, when I was struggling with him, this is what he told ABC News, when I was struggling with him, I felt like a five-year kid under the weight of Hulk Hogan. Now, Hulk Hogan is a wrestler who stands 6'7".
A giant.
A giant, weighing several hundred pounds. And you know that you couldn't have felt an officer in the force feeling like a five-year kid under the weight of an 18-year-old. It's inside here. And so it's that fear that we must come to grapple with.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we see in many instances that is deeply seated. Let me cite two examples that tells us that many of us think that black guys are, you know, they're criminals.
The stereotype.
Mm. And that many of us do believe that. In fact, even on both sides, not just white, even some blacks, you know, will see a group of white kids. It's a group of white kids. If it is black, it's a gang.
There is even, in fact, evidence from some social psychological research,
mm-hmm.
studies, frankly, which have come to that conclusion.
Okay. And, you know, let me cite two examples here that has wrecked this country. First is Susan Smith in South Carolina, mm-hmm. who, wanting to get rid of her two kids, two sons, ages 3 and 5, so she can be free to marry, strapped them in a car seat, drove the car into the pond, came out and said, oh, a black guy attacked me and snatched my car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Number two, Charles Stewart in Massachusetts left his suburban neighborhood, drove his wife, who was 7 months pregnant, into a black neighborhood, shot her so he can get a $250,000 life insurance, and then killed her, called the cops, and said, a black guy attacked and shot us, and my wife is dead. So that tells you something, that there is something embedded in our social and cultural psyche that leads us to easily believe that that could be the case, you know.
But, Marcia, someone might come back to you and say, wait a minute. We're talking about 2015.
Yes.
The man that occupies 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, the White House,
mm-hmm.
is an African-American.
Yes.
The First Lady is an African-American and the two daughters. Isn't that, you know, symbolic enough, frankly, to find out a way of changing people's attitudes, mindsets, and stuff like that? Because let's face it, without a majority of white folks voting for this man, he wouldn't be there.
That's true. I mean, Dr. King's march was not just with African Americans. We knew that we crossed ethnicities on that march. But when you talk about the image of the president of the White House, all we have to do is look at some of the images that people around the United States and around the world, how they have depicted them. They have depicted him, in fact, the whole family, as Planet of the Apes. They have demeaned and the First Lady of our country. So you can also then imagine there's a sense of inflated pride, so to speak. You have a black man in the White House, but that one black man alone in the White House does not change the opinions of a consensus of people who still see black people as inferior. I'm writing an article, I just finished an article for Open Society, for the George Soros organization.
Yes.
And it was really hard for me because this historian wanted me to write about how can we change the perception of black men to white society. I'm like, are you kidding me? There has been nothing. We've become educated. We're in space. We can be CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. And as I said, we can have a black man in the White House. And still, we can have situations in Ferguson and in the White House to happen. I have never seen a president so security being so lacked before in my life. Even I wanted to go in and protect him at some particular points. And I want to say, too, it's not only the profiling of black men. What about the black women who were killed through police brutality that we are silent about? What about the increase of African-American and African descent people who are also young women who are incarcerated as well? And so when we talk about, and this is what I love about the calm of Mrs. Diallo, is that we have to talk about the penal institution rather than educating our children as being that future into which we give our children because of the fear that we have with irrationally about African-American souls. We have been in America over 400 years. When you look at what is happening all over the world, just small decades, in our opinion, of incidents and aflamed everywhere, we have been here 400 years, and except for a few slave insurrections, we've been quite docile. definitely patriotic and a very humane society within America that still seems not to embrace our humanity.
In fact, you may be surprised. We may, in fact, have been here even longer than that because there is this research which talks about they came before Columbus,
yes.
Christopher Columbus. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of our discussion in a moment. But first, here is Mariama Jaro. Take it away, Mariama.
Well, thanks, Shaka. Still to come, we'll reveal some of the fantastic feedback we've received from our audience through social media. But now, here is our letter of the week from a Straight Talk Africa Facebook fan from the United Kingdom.
Alphonse Priera from London writes, I believe using nonviolent protest is the best way to confront racial injustice and conflict simply because if you want to achieve peace, you must show it first. Meanwhile, using violence can only mean one thing, which is destruction and damage. It will send the wrong message to the people.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. Call us now with your questions and comments. The number 202-619-3111. And the U.S. country code is 1. Call direct and we'll call you right back. Remember to keep your questions brief. Now back to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githuya, and welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. Once again, it's time to bring in my colleague and social media reporter, Mariama. Take it away again, Mariama.
Well, Shaka, from 1955 until his death in 1968, Martin Luther King played a major role in the U.S. civil rights movement. Following the teachings of Mahatma Gandhi, Dr. King believed that nonviolent protest is the most effective weapon against a racist and unjust society. A generation later, many still believe that it's the right way to make a difference, while some prefer to use other means to make their voices heard. Well, this leads us to our question of the week, asking, is MLK's legacy of nonviolent protest still the most viable way to confront racial injustice and conflict? Well, we asked the question, and you sent in a variety of responses. And before we dive into your thoughtful comments, I want to thank you first for taking the time to participate in this program via social media and, of course, all the other means. Let's begin with a post from Richard Setuba in Kampala, Uganda, who writes, I think we have been too nonviolent about confronting racial injustice, and we have yielded minimal results. So I am of the view that maybe it should be backed up by some action. Well, another post comes from Nana Akusua in Geneva, Switzerland, who writes, nonviolent civil disobedience and protests are still the best ways to raise awareness on racial injustice. Applying financial pressure is also one of the best ways to push for change while avoiding unnecessary bloodshed. Well, another reminder that we're tweeting live today, use the hashtag VOAMLK. And if you haven't yet, please follow us at VOA Shaka. And speaking of it, let's go to a tweet from Afubu, who writes, what peaceful protest does is to chip on the conscience of the oppressor in a sublime way until they see the need to reciprocate. Well, Shaka and guests, lots of different takes on the topic. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much. And Yedi, how do you react to that?
Yeah, I think, first of all, non-violent, sustained protest is the best way to go. We have come a long way since Martin Luther King Jr., as you mentioned, We have president and first lady. A president has been re-elected twice in a country where the population of blacks is only about 14% tops. Mm-hmm. We have in Massachusetts a governor of African-American descent who has been re-elected twice in a state where the black population is only about 8%. Things have come a long way. We talk of Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, General Powell, etc.
The National Security Advisor is Dr.
Exactly.
Susan Rice.
Yeah, exactly. So things have come a very long way. But the things that Martin Luther King did, we haven't sustained that momentum. Mm-hmm. Because as one respondent said, that we need a sustained engagement of nonviolent protest, chips away at the conscience of people. That's where we need to go. We can enact laws from here to Yin Yang, but if we don't address the consciences of people, old habits die hard. Let me quickly add something here. You know, we employ the police to protect us, right? And they go about to do their job. But somehow society has determined who the bad guys are.
What if someone might ask you, who are those you characterize as us?
The us there would be people of African descent in this country, on the one hand, and on the other, those who are not. Let me explain here. I cited the case of Charles Stewart with a 7-month-old pregnant wife, Susan Smith, with two children.
Plays into the stereotype.
Plays into the stereotype. And you can't do that unless you know that the cultural and social milieu is going to believe you.
Well, hold it. We'll come back to that later. Mariama, do you have any more feedback to share with our audience, please?
Yes, indeed. Let's move on to a comment from Nelson Sakala Jr. in Lusaka, Zambia, who writes, peaceful demonstrations are still the best way to solve the injustices happening around the globe. Most of our leaders do not respond favorably to the wishes of the protesters. We have seen it happening in Syria, where they are tired of demonstrations. Well, another comment from Gideon Langat in Nairobi, Kenya says, racial injustice has become rampant in all fields, from football teams to office professionals in organizations. And to rectify even a fraction of this behavior, people must be educated to respect the human race as the creation of God and not based on the color of a person's skin or their place of origin. Well, Shaka, this comment certainly echoes what Dr. King always said.
Very interesting. Masia, I'm sure that you have watched, like me, Selma, or you have heard about it.
I've seen it. You know, I'm from the city of Chicago, and I remember when Dr. King came, because I was born in 1951. So when he came to Humboldt Park, which was the most racist side on the southwest side of the city of Chicago, I remember when he came in the 60s as well. And the thing about it is, when we talk about having the president being a black man in the White House, we talk about police violence in America, people got to realize around the world, I'm a citizen in the District of Columbia. And so when I travel internationally and people are talking about democracy, I say, hold up. I pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in federal taxes, but yet I do not have a representation in my government. Let's start there about the statehood of Washington, D.C. I said also you have to realize is that one thing I'm hoping that this peaceful protest continues, the persistence of a peaceful protest, is that we also have not ensured our voting rights. People are also internationally alarmed when I tell them if, as an African-American social activist, not standing watch with my other brothers and sisters who are activists, we could very well lose our voting rights as African-Americans, and they're shocked about that. So one thing that I'm proud about with the Ferguson protests is that it has regenerated an activism spirit and a self-sustaining and a self-advocacy within our children, which was sort of arrested during any other incident. But what is more important, too, is an opportunity for the world to see us again. I'm very inclusive in what I see and do and feel. My pain, my heart bleeds for the children in Syria because I've been to the Zaatari camp in Jordan. My heart breaks in the fact that in the northern parts of Nigeria and the border of Chad, that men would dare put a bomb on a child body and detonate them to assault other people. So not only does Black Lives Matter, but all lives matter everywhere for me. And it's not just Sweet Charlie, it's just Sweet Lamont. Mm-hmm. We have to be concerned about the world. And for me, African-American people, when you see in African countries, we have been, African-Americans specifically, have been the moral compass for the social activism within America. We have been the heartbeat and the pulse of this country and have revealed its bigotry, but also its humanity.
Very interesting. You touched on something interesting, especially when you talked about being a resident of Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, mm-hmm. not a state, despite the fact that, frankly, it has more or less the same number of people as some states.
Over 600,000.
That is
true.
And
yet, if you live in the District of Columbia, you have no representation in government. That is not a democracy.
That is interesting, especially mm-hmm. given that when we talk about the great founding fathers, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, we're looking at 1776.
Yes.
A revolution that was triggered, frankly, by no taxation without representation.
Well, I think that a tide would change because when the fight for statehood really started, was initiated, Washington City was the chocolate city. Now this has become cafe au lait, and more whites are moving to the cities, and Black folks have moved out of the city. I guarantee you within 5 years we would have statehood in Washington, D.C., if not sooner, because of the dynamics of migrations from Blacks to the suburbs out of the city and the infiltration of our white brothers and sisters into the nation's capital.
We'll come to that later. Thanks, Mariama, for bringing us this week's audience reaction.
Ms. Dyson, I have to echo that. I, too, am a resident of the District of Columbia, and I'm always cry about this taxation without representation. But let's keep a positive attitude. We have a new mayor. Maybe something will happen while she's here. Well, that will do it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate to us. Please, please, keep them coming. And if you are a new fan, just drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com. Or post your comment on our Facebook page. Just enter the keywords, Straight Talk Africa. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. Or you can join our YouTube channel. Just subscribe to VOA TV to Africa. And certainly don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Well, let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program.
Next week on Straight Talk Africa, Zambians go back to the polls 90 days after they lost their leader, Michael Sata. We'll discuss the results of the recent elections and the copper-producing nation's future next week right here on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much. Let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Buba from the great nation of Nigeria. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Hello.
Hello, Buba, are you?
Hello.
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 Yes, please. Could you turn down the volume on your set, whether it is television or radio set, because we seem to be getting an echo on the line.
Hello.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Buva. I'm glad that a reminder that you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. To participate in our discussion, please call us at 202-619-3111. Yes, country code is 1. We'll continue our discussion in a moment, so please, don't go away.
Dr. King and several other civil rights leaders organized three marches from Selma, Alabama, to the state capital of Montgomery in a bid for voting rights for all. The Bloody Sunday on March 7, 1965, is the first march that involved nearly 600 protesters who marched east from Selma on U.S. Highway 80, led by John Lewis of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Hoja Williams of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Demonstrators were met with so much violence from onlookers and police that the march had to be aborted. When film of the police brutality was broadcast nationwide, it sparked widespread public outrage and helped to boost support for the civil rights movement. In Chicago in August of 1966, Dr. King led about 700 people on a march in mostly white Southwest Chicago to protest housing segregation. Thousands of white people gathered, taunting King and the other protesters. At one point, a brick hit Dr. King in the head, but he continued the march as more people hurled more rocks, bottles, and firecrackers. 30 people, including King, were injured. The Poor People's Campaign in 1968, where Dr. King and the SCLC organized the so-called Poor People's Campaign, which sought to address issues of economic justice and housing for the poor. Dr. King traveled the country to assemble a diverse group of protesters representing the poor who would march on Washington until Congress created a Bill of Rights for poor Americans. Dr. King was assassinated in April of 1968, and the Bill of Rights they envisioned never became law.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
If you like today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook, keywords Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui. Let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers again. And of course, we do have Dennis from Uganda, a land, by the way, that many years ago was characterized by a great British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, as the power of Africa. Good evening, Dennis.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Saka, and our colleagues across the globe.
Well, I have bad news for you because it is good afternoon right here. Good afternoon, Dennis, and it is a good evening your time, of course.
Yeah, good afternoon, Saka Saleh.
Terrific. How are you today?
Uganda is okay. It has also had a drizzle in Uganda this evening.
Hello?
I needed to make a comment over what you are trying to discuss, which is really fundamental issues, if at all we are to remain united as the globe.
You have 1 minute, please.
God had created us to be one people devoid of all our traditional, cultural, and possibly the skin color. But unfortunately, the feeling of inferiority and superiority has come to overrule the world to an extent where there are people who feel that they are above others, and there are also those that seems to be marginalized. And this has been the description and the definition of why the ethnicity and the race has come in to rule the world. And I feel this has been taken by persons in position of authority, and it has got something to do with the cultural and the ethnic blessing. And if at all this is to be checked and corrected, then the skin color shouldn't matter much. And persons of all will must always design a mean thinking that whatever a white man, whatever a black skin, whatever a yellow skin thinks and feels as a matter of social welfare passes across.
I see. Well, do you experience some of those dynamics within the context of Uganda, Dennis?
Yeah, these dynamics are always here. You find that there are people who feel better placed, maybe because of the social and the cultural and financial fabrics and political issues. And maybe it's really very difficult to try to imagine when somebody raises up an issue, they will feel this kind of human beings are not worthy.
Very sad.
And
very sad.
Superior human being in the face of humanity.
Very sad to hear that, but I remember one time interviewing a former UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan, and asking him, how did you make it? Because, frankly, how can you possibly go through all this and become the man on that 38th floor in Manhattan at the United Nations Secretariat? And he said, you know, Shaka, nobody can oppress you or prevent you from doing what you want unless you grant them your consent. Maybe what we need is to grant those people who oppress us our consent. What about that, Aniede? After all, you have this French philosopher, Descartes, who came up with this idea that I think, therefore I am.
Absolutely.
Yeah, what about that?
Yeah, no, you touch on a crucial point here. Because, let's face it, racism is not a monopoly of the United States.
No.
Okay? It spreads across the world. And even in some places where people are the same, those social strata are created to oppress people. Okay, let's take that. I said earlier that there are failures on both sides. And I want to go back to what Martin Luther King tried to do, a sustained education and pricking on the consciences of people. The black community is not doing that enough. It's not. Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's more complicated now because at that time where you had segregation and it was very glaring, we thought, oh, this is evil. But the monster is still there in our community. And so now sometimes we feel, you know, the black community feels talking about it might be indicting our friends in the white community who are equally appalled about what is going on. And in fact, who stand up and oppose it? And, you know, in fact, we have intermarriages in the black-white community now, something that wasn't happening then. It was illegal at one point.
Yes.
So we've come that long way, but then the monster is growing and becoming larger and larger. So what we need is for the black community to join hands with folks in the white community who are so enraged about the systemic exploitation of the underdog here.
And what about the state?
The state, yeah, you know what, sometimes, you know, let's go back to René Descartes you quoted, I think, therefore I am. You know, in this case, you have to tell the state we are here.
But who is the state?
The state...
It is we the people.
It's we the people. So we the people have failed. And so, you know, it's we the people that needs to keep pricking at that conscience that state change things and if it be the voting rights for DC or whatever it is.
Mm.
But we hit and go back and we don't have a sustained engagement of the issues.
There's been a rainbow coalition, you know, in moving any injustice forward to get justice for our people. I mean, that's the great thing about Dr. King. And before I forget, you know, I think about something that Mrs. Dayalo has said about how Coretta Scott King took her under her wing. I want to say that Coretta Scott King also took her husband under the wing and introduced him to Gandhi. And while we're talking about what King would say, like people would say, what would Jesus say? And we think about what Jesus and Dr. King did, that it really were the women who I said were the earthquake and everything after the women, from Fannie Lou Hamer to Rosa Parks to Emmett Till's mom, mm-hmm. Mamie Till in Chicago, were the earthquake that this movement really started shaking. And so just like not only do we need black folks, we have to also have this rainbow coalition and make sure that gender also plays an important role in this as well. When you talk about who's on the front line, it has been the mothers of the fallen sons. Mm. Just recently in 2014, Michael Brown's mom, Trayvon Martin's mother, you know, the gardener's daughter, you know, with her I'm dead sort of exposition that she put on in the city of New York. And we would never say that we have gotten this far beyond a president getting voted by a multiracial constituency and citizenry in America. But it takes this major great humanity heartbeat, this Open Global Hearts, as I've now kind of launched that proactive, yes. consistent protest consistent. That is needed to really change the world. And what we have to do through your social media and through our social medias is show those pictures where people really are getting along. If we see the fraction, we think it's a fractured world. There is some healing, not only in America, around the world. When Bring Back Our Girls happened, American women, all stripes, were outside of your country's embassy, right. saying, bring back our girls, even our first lady. So I think that we need to be able to show that coalition greater so that those who are doing the work, that we know ways, as Fannie Lou Hamer would say, be tired and sick and tired of being tired as
Very
well.
Very interesting. What about some other practical steps that can be taken by the government, really? Because let's face it, you have a situation, was it Staten Island, where you have, I can't breathe.
Uh-huh.
I can't breathe.
Yep.
You still pump bullets?
Exactly.
Why don't you come up, for example, with rubber bullets, which are used in the United Kingdom? Really?
Yes.
You still accomplish what you're looking for. If you are trying to prevent, you know, somebody violating the law and what have you, I think you can still accomplish your goal. Why do you have to shoot to kill?
Yeah, there is a strong militarization of our police force here compared to any other society, you know? And when, as I said, and of course, it opens up another window. Gun control is a no-go area.
Yeah,
I know.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think that we have a population of over 300 and something million people, and we have 235 million guns on the street, I think I need a gun, and I'm a pacifist. I mean, so you could tell the animosity, because the police officers, to their defense, know that they can be outnumbered
that's
when it comes
it,
to gang warfare
that's
as
the
well,
point.
Right?
That's the point.
So,
you know
it's not an either or, it's
both and
in America.
We need a comprehensive approach to this issue. First, address our social and cultural psyche process. We address the issue of guns. Mm. We address, you know, really training community policing. It's very good. In fact, I know
respect for humanity.
Yes. I know some police officers who are so out there for kids. You know, they talk to them and they really talk to them like they're children. And they create a situation where there is trust. And so when that is lacking and every time there is fear, he's going to shoot me, let me kill him first. Mm-hmm. That's not okay.
But why is it that, for example, when LeBron James plays fantastic basketball, everybody cheers?
Well,
white
know,
or black or yellow?
Yeah. Balls and bullets are two different things. A black man on a court, 6 feet tall, weighing over 200 pounds, or in a football field, is a total different reality. But if you want to see the future of African-American young men specifically, then we talk about inferior education in America. Look at the increase in penal institutions in America. So somebody's got to feed that empty house.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. Mm-hmm. On that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Reverend Masiya Dyson, founder and CEO of Women's Global Initiative, and Reverend Aniedi Okule, Executive Director of the Africa Faith and Justice Network, and Kajiatu Jaro, the founder of the Amadou Jaro Foundation, who joined us earlier on today's program by telephone link-up from Gettysburg, Maryland. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, it's Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning in to Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, please. And remember to keep the African hopes alive.
VOA as President Obama delivers the State of the Union, coverage and analysis on TV and online.